moving right along, we've seen global, we've seen Iowa, and now we're going to see a little different view of things. Our next speaker, Dr. Marla McIntosh from University of Maryland, is going to talk to us about climate change. Climate change models, applying climate science to crop science, and I'm told she's going to do more of a micro approach to this. So, Marla?
It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very humbled to be here because I am here mainly with stories from the trenches, having tried to apply some of these models, and I guess my challenge is to bring up essential components and uncertainties about these models, because I have not had the opportunity to go to all the climate modeling sessions, but I will bring to you some of the thinking of the climate modelers after having filtered that as crop scientists, soil scientists, agronomic scientists. So my first thing is a disclaimer. I'm not a climate scientist, but I do pay my dues to the tri-societies, each one of them. And just as a philosophy thing, I'm not addressing just crop scientists, but all tri-societies. I think that Jerry brought out some of those important points that we can't just look at the crop science alone. Anyway, so it is Wednesday, and I think that it's time to kind of shake it up a little, okay? How many of you have ever worked with climate change models? Okay, then you may disagree with the things I say, and I hope that you'll bring it up later in our discussions, because I'm just giving you a beginner's eye view. To put this in context, about 3 years ago, I was at a committee meeting. It was a group of land use managers with urban forestry, and we were given an offer that if anyone wanted to, we could have hot off the press downscaled data that was downscaled to 8 kilometer pixels. So that is a really small area. And so I said, ooh, I would love to use that. That sounds really exciting. Well, I didn't see that I had guinea pig written all over my face. And that is that 8 kilometers, as I know now, is really an absurdly small area to predict weather for. So these global models are usually, at a minimum, something like 150 kilometers. The regional models will be 50 kilometers. And here they were going to go down to 8. Using a model that I'll describe in a bit. And a lot of this is what I'm going to be presenting is colored by my experiences with my graduate student, Stephanie Jukes, who got her master's working with the data, and a special acknowledgement to John Strack, who is a climatologist that gave us the data and, thank goodness, worked with it on it. And just flipping to the end, don't try any of this without a collaboration. I think that one of my major points is that if you're going to work with climate models, make it a multidisciplinary effort, because they are so, at least for me, out of my league. And I'll have some stories about how I learned that the hard way. So, moving on, the genesis of climate science really comes from weather forecasting. And the 8 kilometer downscaled data that we were getting was from a weather model, weather research forecast model, WRF model. One of the big obstacles to working in climate science is that everything is an acronym, and I still don't know what they mean. I mean, they have a different language, and you have to stop them and ask them, what is that? You learn a lot that way. But anyway, so the scientific study and long-term observations of weather pattern led to the development of climate science. So the difference is weather is what is going to happen tomorrow or 10 days from now. Climate is what is going to happen in the next decade or the decade after. And a lot of what you've seen presented is shooting for 2050, which sounds so far away, but when I teach students, I realize that that is when they will be my age. So for some of us, I don't see anyone in the audience that would be that age, but it's really an important date. Okay, so over the last 25 years, there has been incredible progress in weather forecast models. And this is from a paper that was in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society. And this is for weather forecasts. And to briefly interpret this for you, and that is the higher the level, the better, the more accurate the forecast would be. So you can see that forecasters can forecast 3 days in advance very well. And from 1980, which is the beginning of the graph, till 2010, it's improved tremendously. One is the northern and one is the southern hemisphere. They're doing really well. Look at 10 days. They've made incredible progress, as they say, but still not good. So think about it. You're predicting 10 days in advance the weather. This is just temperature. Think about doing that 10 years in advance, 20 years in advance, 30 years in advance. You don't do it on a small range. You do it on a decade. But the problem with plants is they don't care what the decade is like. You know, they're experiencing the weather at the moment where they are in real time. Okay? And you all know, you saw from some of these graphs, there's a lot of variation there. Okay. So we're making progress, and the progress from the weather forecasting has trickled down to making great progress in the weather climate models. So there is now an increasing quantity and quality of weather data, and this has benefited climate scientists, and the models have been fine-tuned, validated, and the initial models were all global climate models predicting huge average changes on a large scale over large periods of time. They were driven by different forcing factors, and their mechanistic models. Very different. I deal usually with statistical models, and the mechanistic models are based on fundamental physics. And for temperature, it's relatively simple, not to me, but it is. You know, the radiation comes in, the radiation goes out, you have carbon dioxide. Precipitation. Jerry, you were talking about precipitation? I'm sorry, but I respectfully disagree because I don't think we have a clue what is going to happen to precipitation. The predictions for precipitation are really sketchy, the reason being that it's a different level. The precipitation depends on the temperature. So if you don't have a good prediction of temperature, you can't have a prediction of precipitation. But the previous graph I showed you was for forecasting temperature. Forecasting precipitation is not as certain. How many times do you say, that weatherman really lied to me? Okay? If you're packing for, not San Antonio, but let's say you're packing to go to Maryland, where I'm from, and you look at the 10-day forecast and it says it's not going to rain for 10 days, still you bring an umbrella. Okay? And this is one of the points that has not been brought up yet, and I want to really make a big point about it, diversity. For the future, we can predict what's going to happen with uncertainty and without a lot of precision. Our confidence continues to increase every year because of all the science that's going into it. But diversity is the only insurance. You need to have genetic diversity. And I think John Soper, who will be talking after the break, I'm sure that he'll make some major points about how that is really essential in all breeding efforts, because we really don't know when El Nino will come. So there are forces that direct these models. Weather models are a lot simpler because they're based usually on these physical properties, which we've been studying for eons, but you go to the climate models and they have a huge human component. So they have the scenarios that come out of the IPCC, intergovernmental, I can't do it right now. Okay, they will predict decades, and they depend on how much the population is going to grow, how energy efficient we become, you know, so we know what's going to change in the carbon dioxide. Okay. So first thing is, if you have not worked in with the models, but you have this curiosity about how good they are and how they're developed, if you go to the IPCC website, they have some wonderful reports, and at the end I'll give you some recommended readings. But this just came out of Science Magazine a couple of months ago, and it was an issue devoted to data. It's a wonderful issue. And OVERPEC has these predictions about where the climate data is going to, the volume is going to go over the next 20 years. And as you can see, it's hugely expanding. So according to him, and I agree, there's going to be a real need for physical archiving and sharing. And I will give you my story about how don't try this at home, because if you're not a climate scientist, you'll never be able to find what you're looking for. So we need to have this sharing, but we also need to, I think, collaborate with those that understand the data. And then the ease of access and finding. And it, maybe I'm slow, but it's not easy to find. And as OVERPEC says, especially for non-climate scientists, because our questions are different from their questions. We need different focus to our data that we're going to be looking at. Okay, so did I go forward? I'm going backward. Time can't go backwards, though. Thank you. Okay, got it. So the thing that I want to point out to you that is really important, and important for everybody in this room, is they talk about this huge volume, but they're divided into three different types of data. One is the gold bars are the model data. And notice the boom in that? Sure, no problem, because it's self-replicating. You feed it into models, and it makes new data. It doesn't take much time. Well, computer-wise, it really does. You know, you need this huge supercomputers. But it increases because it's no human labor, okay? Then you have the remotely sensed weather data. The satellites out there, they're gathering data like crazy now. It's wonderful. And they have become increasingly finer resolution. You know, what you see in Google is just amazing. So that is really exploding also. But there's the in situ other, the ground data that's coming from land measurements. Do you see an explosion there? No. And that's a real need, and that's a real need that agronomists can start filling the bill, because when I went to get data, I went to I'm in Maryland at Land Grant System, our area experiment stations, which have always kept temperature and precipitation data. So I was able to get their records, but I was not able to get them on the websites that have climate data. So for us, for validating things, we're generating a lot of very good data, but I don't think it's really accessible to anybody. Okay, so what is the value of all this information? We surely have plenty. I would call it information overload, kind of like you're probably having presentation overload. So I'll try to make this as interesting as possible. But it depends. First of all, it depends on what the data source is. If you have human or observation measurements, there are certain uncertainties associated with it. You know, you can have measurement error. You can have lots of things coming in. When I told an older researcher that I was getting temperature data from one of the experiment stations, he goes, "Oh, I know the technician there. Good luck." You know, because he was looking at it and recording it. That introduces error. But you can have automated measurement that as long as the machine's running, you're good. You have the calculated data sources, like I said, that are generated from the models. You have things that are transcribed or written down, can generate errors, estimated, rounded, transformed, anything you want, including invented, fabricated, or imagined and plain ridiculous data, which I often find in newspapers and that more people see than the people seeing the credible data, unfortunately. So it's the old statistical thing that any model is only as good as the data that's going in it. The next question is, it's only valuable if you can make meaning from it. And that's where the collaborations are really important, because the climate scientist does not necessarily know what you need to know. But I found out if you work with the right people and you ask, you can work with them to figure out how you can get what you need, such as not just the average temperature, but the maximum temperatures and the minimum temperatures, or, you know, any of these things can be obtained, but you have to ask how to get it. And that's why they were looking for a guinea pig. They wanted to know what the users wanted to know. Okay? And can the data be applied to answer important questions? You know, data doesn't do any good unless it is being utilized effectively. And then what is the connection between your data and knowledge and wisdom? Anyone that deals with quantitative issues, you know that that's takes a lot of sophistication, okay, to go from one to the other. I have got to figure out which way to go. So just a brief rundown that you have your global models that are based on atmospheric general circulation, and there are big areas, and they're very computationally intensive. Their model dynamics do improve as the resolution increases, in other words, as the pixel size goes down, but at the same time, systematic errors, and I found this out, tend to increase as the resolution decreases. Thus, 8 kilometers did that. Okay, had systematic errors. Then from that, a more recent development is to have regional climate models. And there are many of them, and they are used with downscaled models that are within a limited area. So you can think of them as nested within these areas, and they are dynamic models, again, kind of mimicking what's happening at the global scale. And for those, that's what we're more interested in, because you'll have better spatial detail. And by putting in the physical attributes and things of the region, they become computationally efficient. So you probably could handle on your computers regional models, but you couldn't do the global model. And then the final one, which I find very compelling, is using statistical downscaling of things so that you compare it to what has happened, the large-scale variables on a regional level, compare the observed value from the past, and then you feed this into statistical models so you can correct for the bias and then project from that. So you have your big ones, and there are some obstacles to that because they can't be calibrated. How can you calibrate to a future? Because as soon as you get there to calibrate, it's no longer the future. Okay, so from experimental design thing, we're at a loss. And also, we don't even know that what we're projecting is going to even be relevant when we get there to 2050. So these are 5 sources of uncertainty that will be online, and the biggest uncertainty is with people. And if you accept that people are influencing and a major driver of climate change, then you know that people are even more unpredictable than the physical components of the atmosphere. Maybe not volcanoes and things. But so we have different emission scenarios used for that. The downscaled models, again, they're high resolution and computationally efficient. So let's look at some of the output from this, just to give you an idea. And here we have summer temperatures. And on the left-hand side are the observed averages. This is what has been happening from 71 to 90. And then this is a Canadian regional model that they use. And those are the anomalies. In other words, the difference between the predicted and the observed from the past. So the darker the blue is 6 degrees too cool that they predicted on average. These are monthly temperatures. And the gray is where they were not significantly different. And then the yellow or the red, they overestimated. In general, we have had underestimates, under predictions of how much the climate temperature is going to increase. But another point is, look at the precipitation data, and you'll see highly red areas. That's where you're really way off for the right-hand side. In other words, the temperature and precipitation are very different, the certainty of the prediction. The precipitations, the differences were very troublesome, okay? In other words, diversity. You really can't put your money on things happening with precipitation. Okay, so for the regional models, they have what is called bias-corrected and spatially downscaled data. And I don't have time to go into it, but I have, again, for the presentation, it'll be online, a website where you can go and look at it. There's so many advances, and that's why I say, if I tell you right now that the climate regional climate change models are uncertain, that changes every year, so don't remember what I'm telling you, okay, because next year it's going to be different. And this is an example of what they have on their website. Really nice graphics. Now, a little bit for my part is that we looked at weather station data across Maryland for temperature and precipitation. We found that there were huge differences. These are three different regional models. And the WRF model, which is a weather model, you can see for different parts of Maryland that it consistently underestimated maximum summer temperatures. But not only that, is it didn't recognize that the temperatures would be different from the eastern region to the western region, which the green is the observed. It's a solid trend that's we know is there. Okay, and it totally missed it. The other models were okay, but you traditionally make an ensemble of models. That is really the best approach. You merge models together and they kind of average out. What you don't do is something that I tried, and that is take the local predictions and average those. Then your systematic errors just go way out. But I had to try it, you know. Anyway, to wrap it up, there are recommended reports, and again, these will be online, but the IPCC reports are excellent. There is an excellent report on strengths and limitations of climate models that was put out in 2008. There, for just understanding basic climate change, National Academy of Sciences has a report, Understanding and Responding to Climate Change. I use that with my students. I give that to my students because it's so readable and really concise. And then there are recommended websites for you, those of you that teach. There is something called an Earth Exploration Toolbook, which if you want to have exercises for the students to actually get hands-on experience with the data, they can go to, and it has different case studies these are some examples of them, but I challenge you all to contact them because there is not one single case study that has the word agriculture in it. We need it. And then there's another website that I just love. It's called Databasin, and it is, again, I have it on my presentation, but it has data sets, maps, galleries, but it also has groups. So you can start collaborations there. You can interact together and have a social community based on focuses. And finally, think ahead, but not too far. Continue to reflect again and again and again. An iterative approach is probably the only practical approach. And finally, I just want to again thank my graduate student, Stephanie, and Dr. John Strock, who was a research associate at the Earth System Science Lab. Thank you.